Everyone went to work drafting propaganda material to advertise the protest planned for Monday, August 15th. In a mode familiar from Operation Avenge Assange, the organizers acted as choreographers, to borrow Paolo Gerbato's fitting term, who harnessed and directed a fireball of fury. Alongside the protest and propaganda, some individuals engaged in some rather dicey, although admittedly lulzy behavior. It was these acts that attracted mainstream media attention. For instance, someone claiming the mantle of Anonymous found a racy, semi-nude photo of Bart's Lyndon Johnson on his personal website. This photo was then republished on the Bart Lulz website to considerable fanfare, along with this brazen rationalization. If you are going to be a dick to the public, then I'm sure you don't mind showing your dick to the public. You mad, bro? Hashtag Bart Lulz. But more than anything else, it was a string of hacks that attracted national media coverage, from CNN to Democracy Now! First, there was a website defacement on August 14th. The interlopers simply defaced mybart.org with an image of Guy Fawkes. This was followed almost immediately by an intrusion that exposed the private data of 2,500 BART customers. A day after the second protest at the Civic Center BART station, organized by Anonymous and local activists, there was another intrusion, on August 17th, into a BART police union website. This resulted in the publishing on Pastebin of the home addresses, email addresses, and passwords of 102 BART police officers, among other employees. The day I returned from Germany, Democracy Now! Contacted me to inquire whether I could join them the next day to speak about Op BART. I dreaded the prospect of being asked about the blatant privacy violations committed by such hacks, and the gymnastics required to explain the use of such tactics by a collective that ostensibly fought to protect privacy. Thankfully, the next day I was joined on live TV by masked Anon activist Commander X, and it was he who was asked to offer a rationale. Amy Goodman. And your thoughts on going after the actual passengers themselves, people who might not want that personal information out? X. How else do you get the world to respond and secure your information? How else do you get these companies and these big governments to keep your information, the information you give them voluntarily, safe? I think we got our message across, and I'll bet you one thing. I'll bet you they fix that. Commander X, who spoke through a voice distorter, was not responsible for the breach, but the alleged perpetrator and a minority of other Anonymous activists shared their rationale. At the time, I had no idea who was behind the hacks, nor how other Anons viewed this breach. But soon after the interview, I returned home to find out. Although there was tremendous, almost unilateral support among Anons for protesting Bart's act of censorship, the hacking and dumping of private customer data was one of the most internally divisive acts I had yet witnessed. Conversation on the channels and even publicly over Twitter was brimming with criticism. Consider, for instance, what happened when Lomaline 5 milligrams logged into the public Op BART channel on August 17th and claimed responsibility for the BART police union website hack. She offered a link to the docs. Lomaline 5 milligrams. Hello, y'all. Crappy tires. Hi, Lomaline 5 milligrams. Lomaline 5 milligrams. I have a small contribution. Pastebin.com/XX7DJBQW. A leak from BARTPOA.com, BART Police Officers Association. Enjoy and share. Crappy Tires. Crappy Tires doesn't like info leaks. Op No Pro. Were those names ever shared before? Lomaline 5 milligrams. What? I don't know, I guess not. Op No Pro. You dropped names and passwords. We run a very clean operation here. We are not interested in anything like that. Please refrain from dropping anybody's private information anywhere on Anonymous's behalf. Not interested in breaching somebody's privacy. They have a right to it as much as you do. Not everyone agreed with Op No Pro. Others vocally supported the black hat ways of Anon Ops. Sharpie, That's his dump. OptnoPro. Do your jobs privately and nobody needs to know. Sharpie, shut the fuck up. Lomaline 5 milligrams. It's not my fault for their crappy security. OptnoPro. Take it easy, sharp pen. This is not a question for debate. This is a question about keeping things separate. Sharpie. People think this IRC is a fucking church knitting group. OptnoPro. Please understand the situation. Sharpie. Yeah, I do. A lot more than you. OptnoPro. There are many portions to the IRC. Crappy Tires looks for the knitting group. OptnoPro. Take it easy, sharp pen. Wake up. Keep it separate. Sharpie. Take your moral faggotry white hat shit and shove it. OptnoPro. And if you ever see me in a knitting club, that will be in your eyes. You have no idea what my morals are. Sharpie concluded by echoing one of the most common rationales. Sharpie, how much publicity do you think Pound Op Bart would have had without database dumps? And then Lomaline 5 milligrams said that she was not even anonymous, raising the ontological question of just what makes one anonymous anyway. She showed up on the anonymous IRC server, proffered some docs, and then proceeded to work with other Anons to craft a message to the press. If that doesn't make one an Anon, then what does? Regardless, the distinction mattered little in relation to the more general ethical questions surrounding hacking and doxing. By now, thanks to AntiSec, these tactics were a common fixture in the anonymous landscape and would only grow more controversial. Lomaline 5 milligrams. This is not anonymous. Fuck you. W. OptnoPro, like it or not, fractal chaos and tactics diversity is what is fueling global revolution. Alba and Omegali. Anon is a shit starter, because it works. OptnoPro, take the dumps somewhere else. W. OptnoPro, you cannot prevent people from using an operation name for doxing, DDoSing, and hacking. OptnoPro, even if that was the right choice, you simply can't. Lomaline 5 milligrams. I don't use the operation name. Versions of this conversation would be repeated at least a dozen times elsewhere over the next few days. My reading was that most participants on Anon Ops opposed the privacy-violating dumps, but were mainly supportive of the other illegal tactics, like the BART website defacement, the email and fax bombing, and the DDoS, regardless of the fact that it failed. BART had implemented good DDoS protection. A minority supported the doxing simply because it served the greater purpose of media attention, or was an example of the fractal chaos that partly defined Anonymous. The doxing also marked the first time that suspicions of a false flag operation fully flared within Anonymous. A false flag operation is a secret intervention in which a government agent performs a controversial action on behalf of a political group to seed mistrust and controversy or provide justification for the government's own escalated response. 2 days later, Lomaline 5 milligrams published a statement on Pastebin that seemed to quell rumors of a false flag, though it did little to extinguish the controversy. I find it shameful that the media do not condemn taking such drastic actions against a protest after the killing of an innocent citizen. He was not proven guilty, or do they actually judge people at their funeral, implying this guy got a proper funeral? I also find it disturbingly sad that the San Francisco Bay Area local media is being so supportive of the right to remain anonymous of the BART police personnel when they didn't give a shit about this man being killed. Did they condemn the killing of this man? All I did was give them, the cops, a taste of their own medicine. In other words, Lomaline, which is an anal analgesic, look it up. It also means the cunning in French. In a subsequent interview with SF Weekly, Lomaline 5 milligrams claimed to be French, female, and a preteen, the last two being unlikely. She said that the BART hack marked her very first intrusion. In the midst of all this, a Pastebin.com message titled "Anonymous is not unanimous" was picked up and read by many participants. Anonymous has a perception problem. Most people think we are a group of shadowy hackers. This is a fundamental flaw. Anonymous is groups of shadowy hackers, and herein lies the problem. Anonymous has done a lot of good in just the past 9 months. It has helped with other groups in providing aid to people on the ground in countries where democracy is a bad word. The mainstream media needs to understand that Anonymous isn't unanimous. I've yet to see wide-scale reporting make this distinction. A destructive minority is getting a majority of the press, while those of us who toil in the shadow doing good work for people at home and abroad go unthanked. This statement captures Anonymous's commitment to difference, plurality, and dissension, similar in form to the type of adversarial politics advocated by radical theorist Chantal Mouffe. Anons often disagree and engage in a strong war of words, but very little energy is spent on systematically trying to eliminate difference or carving out some middle ground resolution. Instead, differences are loudly voiced, listened to, responded to, and reluctantly accepted. Anons widely acknowledge that nothing drastic or meaningful can be done to eliminate differences, and they carry on with their interventions, or, if the disagreements are unbearable, break away to form a new node. Fuck anti-sec. The Op-Bart hacking controversy eventually receded, but one controversy remained. As weeks turned into months, criticism of anti-sex defacements and hacks mounted, even as the group's support base grew. Some Anons saw anti-sec as reckless, and many were suspicious of its motives. Rumors circulated that not only particular actions, but also the entirety of anti-sec might be a false flag operation. Anti-sec, perhaps unsurprisingly, was simultaneously respected, tolerated, and vilified. Many of anti-sec's core members had been essential to past iterations of the anonymous/anon-ops/lulsec constellation. Their significance coincided with the partial fading of WikiLeaks, which suffered from internal frictions and legal troubles. Anti-sec, it was hoped, might expand to more directly challenge the powers wielded by corporations and governments, not simply by producing momentary spectacles, as is the case with DDoS attacks, but also by whistleblowing, locating and releasing hard evidence of malfeasance. Despite constant hacks during the late summer and early fall of 2011, very little of real substance was uncovered. Had Sabu not been an informant, it is likely that anti-sec would have delivered more. The FBI notified some companies of breaches, prompting the fast patching of holes, effectively closing doors that anti-sec had only just opened. One Anon who had been centrally involved since the fall of 2010 quit in August 2011, largely in disgust over anti-sec. While lulsec dumped plenty of data, such as usernames, email addresses, passwords, emails, and other documents, much of it was seen to lack political weight. And yet anti-sec managed to remain in the spotlight. People began to resent this. There were many small crews operating, most of them outside of the public eye. The possibility was raised that anti-sec had become counterproductive, funneling attention, labor, and resources into worthless activities. Another hacker, who had been a core member of a non-ops IRC staff, explained, "We got pissed off that anti-sec was thrown on us. We had no warning, and they'd been planning it for a while, co-opting people from here." Worse, anti-sec began to raise hackles among some Anons for a time-honored anonymous taboo, fame-seeking. One Anon relayed this view on IRC in September 2011 in the course of resigning from the group. Pseudonym has been changed. Ha. What the fuck happened to pound anti-sec? Let me tell you a story. Gather round, kids. Once upon a time, there was a team of status fag hackers, most of which were okay as people. We all have our flaws. They came to be known as lulsec. Those hackers decided it would be a good idea to use their status fag powers to gather Anons against the infosec industry. It was then someone decided to give monkeys machine guns and taught them the weakness of SQL tables. These monkeys decided they wanted to look good for lol's sake and hacked every possible thing they could, releasing all the information they plundered, regardless to such things as consequence and public relations. Private data leaked faster than WikiLeaks brand condom. They continued hacking away, hoping to gain a pat on the back from Sabu. Then the summer vacation ended. They found themselves unable to continue their hackery as more pressing matters became apparent, such as who do I sit with during lunch and what's a cooler elective to take, French or band? Thus ends the saga of Pound Anti-Sec. Earlier in the summer, the Anon Ops Network had grown so critical of Barrett Brown that he decided to quit. He was adamant that he was no longer involved in Anonymous, focusing his energy on Project PM, a team wiki dedicated to documenting the inner workings of private contractors doing security work for the government. Later, Brown would assume the moniker of Anonymous again, to take on the Mexican drug cartels, a dumb and dangerous bluff. And he would also receive information for Project PM from Anti-Sec when the group finally procured sensitive data from a security firm called Stratfor. But that was months away. Brown remained, at that time, a reminder that attention-seeking behavior was frowned on. Anti-Sec's attention-seeking was more ambivalent and complicated than it had been with Brown. Unlike Brown, Anti-Sec sought attention under a pseudo-anonymous mantle. And some Anon stood by the crew's actions, holding out hope that their efforts would eventually produce some political, classified, or secret information impossible to procure legally. A cohort of Black Hat hackers, unaffiliated with Anonymous, had had enough with Anti-Sec. A group of underground hackers going by the name Brick Squad, which they seemed to have assumed only temporarily, released a document that included some purported doxes of Anonymous and Anti-Sec members. They opened by declaring, "Fuck Anonymous, fuck Anti-Sec, fuck Anonymous, fuck Anti-Sec." Further along, they did not mince words. And you wonder why the 90s groups you shout out with kids and families won't come out of retirement to help you? You have accomplished nothing except inflaming cyber war rhetoric and fueling legislation that will end up with hackers getting 50 years in prison. The most retarded part is that you don't even realize you are the cause of the very thing you hate. Every time you DDoS a company, Prolexic or DOS Arrest sign up a new customer. Every time you SQL inject some irrelevant site, a pen testing company gets a new contract. Every time you declare cyber war on the government, federal contractors get drowned in grant money. Other hackers and netizens also began accusing Anonymous of fortifying the cyber war industrial complex. But it's worth noting that long before Anonymous came to prominence, national governments around the world already aspired to control the internet and were already developing statutes that eroded individual rights and privacies. Cybersecurity initiatives would be well-funded with or without Anonymous. This is not to say that all the group's actions are justified. Still, in the face of such a gargantuan surveillance state, what Anonymous has enabled is a flexible platform for citizens to express their dissent over long-entrenched trends. But Brick Squad, wedded foremost to the black hat sensibility, ended the diatribe with a set of threats that harkened right back to the original Anti-Sec mindset. If you support Anti-Sec in any way, you will be targeted. Journalists, musicians, lawyers, web hosts, VPN providers, political commentators, profiteering businesses, you are all valid targets. You stepped into our world. If you don't want to play the game, get the fuck off the playing field. We have love for the scene. Fuck the media. Brick Squad. Chapter 10. The desire of a secret is to be told. Summer in New York City is oppressive. Soaring temperatures combine with the harsh metropolitan reality to create a dystopian urban hellion. The sun, reflected off the glass skyscrapers, blinds you. Subterranean orifices lead to the city's viscera, the bowels of the stations and the intestines of the subway system spitting people out. Sweat, sounds, sights, as if these were not enough, you are also enclosed by the mephitic, durian-like rot of the city, smells of deceased rats and human waste, oven-baked by subway stations. So when the cooler fall weather finally settles in, the city sighs with collective relief. The hanging leaves of dazzling burnt yellow, amber, and orange provide a complement to olfactory respite. The swing to fall feels like a new lease on life. Finally, you won't be sweating all night long. Finally, the smell will be washed away. Finally, respite. On September 17th, 2011, I awoke to a bundle of delicate pink, purple, and red flowers protruding from a vase encased in a Guy Fawkes mask. It was my birthday. The timing was perfect. It was a day of protest in New York City. The financial collapse had seared its streak of corruption, oligarchy, and the 1% into the minds of an angry generation. Instead of being depressed, oppressed, and immobilized by the combination of the financial situation and the city's heat, the day was crisp, and it felt like there was a refreshing optimism that people were ready to act upon. Nobody wanted to call it hope. It was too early to declare such a thing, but the possibility was still on the table. I grabbed the mask and made my way to Bowling Green, near Wall Street. Approaching the small grassy park, I spied out of the corner of my eye a number of young men with Guy Fawkes masks slung over their shoulders. Upon seeing me, a pair of them nodded. One gave a thumbs up and told me to keep up the good work. By early afternoon, protesters had marched to what became the event's target and nerve center, Zuccotti Park, later renamed Liberty Square. Many came and went as the day inched toward twilight and the first General Assembly, but a steady stream of younger activists continually trickled in with camping equipment on their backs and threw their gear down. Even if Occupy was defined by its rootedness in a place, it was understood that social media could and should play a vital role. Not the, nor even a, central agent of revolution, online communication acted more like an adjuvant. It provided an essential boost, facilitated coordination, and allowed those unable to attend bodily to witness and become invested and entangled in the events. And so on that first day of Occupy, many of us were hooked to our phones even as we were present at the square. Every half hour or so, I would fetch my phone from my pocket and skim through my Twitter feed. In the afternoon, two back-to-back messages from Sabu vaulted off the screen. A month prior, on August 16th, Sabu had vanished from Twitter after enigmatically tweeting, "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he did not exist. And like that, he is gone." These new tweets marked his reemergence with a roar. "Attention. I never left. I am not at Anon Sabu or any of those posers. I wasn't owned, arrested, hacked, or any of the other rumors. Go get lives." He followed with another. "They tried to snitch me out, troll me, dox everyone around me, bait me into endless arguments, but there's one thing they can't do. Stop me." In an early August chat, Sabu had warned me he was going dark. "Sabu is a name that doesn't need to exist eventually," he wrote. "Biela." "Well, okay, then, Not saying it does either, nor that you should stick around here, just saying don't be a stranger, Sabu." "Sabu. Well, it's not like I'm leaving to be a dick or run away. It's just that the community itself needs to look towards itself for motivation, not me. I feel too many people follow me, and I'm not here to be a leader. Yes, I'm a natural-born leader. And yes, if I wanted to, I can lead this entire movement on my own if I wanted to live like a dictator. But truth is, I'm not the leader of anything involved with Anonymous. And by me leaving, I prove this point." Following his exit from Twitter, and unbeknownst to myself, Sabu remained active on various secret IRC channels. Also unknown to me, and in this case, even to those he worked so closely with online, the day before our chat, on August 15th, he had appeared in court. He had pled guilty to all 12 charges leveled against him, including conspiracy to commit bank fraud and aggravated identity theft, and 3 counts of conspiracy to commit computer hacking. Facing 124 years, he agreed to work for the government in exchange for the reduction of his maximum sentence to 100 years. He also assented to the obligation to commit no further crimes whatsoever. Unlike his earlier disappearance in June due to his also secret arrest, this time he had notified people that he was going to take some time off. Anti-sec members came and went, a factor that further disabled suspicion of Sabu. He also created a permanent connection to IRC using what is typically called an IRC bouncer, proxy, or screen session. When he wished, he could then reattach himself to the permanent connection. This enabled him and the FBI to have access to all conversations on the channels, and people could send him messages, even when he was not online. Sabu's method of connecting aroused no mistrust because it is common for hackers, many who are terminal junkies, to rely on such technical proxies. When he initially left, I took his reasoning at face value. But he was also going dark to deflect some strong accusations that had recently come his way. Just before his public disappearance in August, a hacker named Mike Virus Neves accused Sabu of being a snitch. The logs of this exchange quickly surfaced on Pastebin. It started with Sabu obliquely suggesting that someone in Virus's crew was a rat. Virus bit back hard. Virus: regarding Topiary, you ratted him out. It's so obvious, Sabu. Sabu: my nigga. Virus: but I keep my mouth shut. Sabu: you better watch your fucking mouth because I'm not a rat. Virus: I don't get involved. Sabu: and I definitely didn't rat my own boy. Virus: I don't care if Anonymous gets owned. Sabu: I can tell you exactly how he got knocked. Virus: I never liked them, never will. Sabu: and if you actually knew anything, you'd know how it went down, too. For a hot minute, there was some troll on Twitter that had hit up A Topiary's Twitter mentions with... Virus: Anonymous is nothing but a bunch of fat, pimply basement-dwelling losers who masturbate 3+ times a day. Sabu: Jake from Shetland. He got it from an Xbox forums. Topiary was an avid Xbox gamer. Was known in the community, talked a lot. One of the forum users doxed him and kept throwing the info out there, enough that someone was smart enough to make the connection. Virus: I'm a social engineer. A professional social engineer, actually. Sabu: I'm a social engineer, too. Sabu tried to defuse the accusation, first by showering Virus with compliments, but when that failed, he switched strategies. Sabu: you'd know that if I were raided, I'd take myself down, if anything. I'm the martyr type. I grew up in the street. Virus: it's a hunch. I'm always right. Sabu: this time, you're wrong. I'd rather go down for my own shit than take down my own niggas. At the time, the accusations seemed plausible, but certainly not definitive. It was just as likely that the spat stemmed from personal conflict, hacker drama, or that Mike Virus was himself a snitch, trying to deflect attention. Virus even admitted that there was little evidence to back up his accusation. He was relying on a hunch. As usual, Sabu was suave and fierce in staving off the accusations. Regardless, his lowered profile signaled that he was being careful. During his hiatus, Anonymous did just fine. The group had gone full throttle with Op Bart, and soon after, Occupy engaged its collective attention. Making ops run smoothly requires an increased amount of communication and shared time online, so it is not surprising that in these intensive moments, the rumors exploded like a backdraft, or that they burnt out almost as abruptly as they had flared up. Sabu's return on September 17th, the day Occupy started, was a shrewd move that helped nourish his mythos as a bona fide revolutionary. Like a salmon who knows to return thousands of miles upriver to where it was born, Sabu, it seemed, was programmed to show up at an important political happening. His reappearance sent the following message: the allure of a protest overrides everything else. The revolution was what mattered, and accusations that seemed justified by his disappearance quickly looked more like unfounded drama. Sabu seemed truly excited by Occupy, and as it gained momentum, he tweeted about it frequently. Other Anons became similarly preoccupied. The turnout on the first day was so meager that Nathan Schneider, who became one of the most prominent chroniclers of the movement and later wrote a book about it, recalled, "I didn't think it would last. I didn't think it would change anything." But thanks to the persistence of the occupiers, thanks to the social media messages, and thanks to the police, who sparked mass media attention and public outrage by cracking down against peaceful protesters and marches, in less than 2 weeks, Occupy transformed from smoking embers into a bonfire. My days are numbered. The first week of Occupy, I returned to the camp a few times and would later join some of the large New York City marches. But as a full-time professor with two classes, a book to finish, and a string of appointments in preparation for an approaching move to a foreign country, it was tough to be there as much as I would have liked. Sometimes other factors kept me away as well. On Tuesday, September 20th, my day seemed to be miraculously free, but gazing out my window into the drizzly morning, I was prompted to contemplate all the other valid uses of my time. And call it fate, but had it not been for this lazy reluctance, I might never have met Sabu in the flesh. Of course, reflecting now on the events that transpired, I can only think that it might have been better if I had braved the rain. Late in the afternoon that day, the rain now gone, I headed to NYSEC, the informal meetup of security professionals. I ambled toward Swift, a Greenwich Village bar. From a distance, I spotted Weave, the famous troll who had headed up Goatsea Security and now lived in the tri-state area, awaiting trial. A cigarette dangled from his mouth, and he was talking to two people I did not know. Weave was tipsy and content. You could tell that he was gearing up for a good rant. He sported a pin from Trinity Church, where he regularly attended service, and the sermon he was preparing was on the subject of Occupy. It was unclear whether he supported Occupy or merely saw it as an opportunity to troll. He gave one memorable speech, managing to indict the evil financiers, call out police brutality with a nod to Oscar Grant, and speak to state threats against artisanal cheesemakers, all in 4 minutes. But at other times, Weave also held up a sign, "Zionist pigs rob us all." Weave greeted me. Upon hearing my name, one of the other hackers raised his eyebrows. "So are you Gabriella, who studies Anonymous?" he asked. I replied in the affirmative. Weave updated us about Occupy, and we headed inside. We fetched some drinks and settled into the back room with the 20 or so hackers already there. I figured that the other hacker, let's call him Freddy, likely followed Anonymous from a distance, like many security researchers. But as it turned out, he knew a lot more than I could have imagined. As the evening wore on, Freddy and I found ourselves in a dark corner of the bar. "Are you an FBI agent?" he asked, a question that no longer rattled me the way it might have only a few months previous. I replied, in a somewhat annoyed tone, "No, in fact, I just accepted a position in Canada. Why would the FBI ship me off to a country they largely ignore if I were working for them?" He clearly knew a great deal about Anonymous, including the secret back-channel IRC groups like Pound Internet Feds. I was informed, also, that he was arranging a meeting between Sabu and Parmi Olsen, who was in the midst of writing a book on Anonymous. Olsen says this didn't happen, though she did acknowledge having contact with Freddy. As our conversation unfolded, it became increasingly clear. He was deep inside Anonymous and seemed to have known Sabu for quite some time. Freddy also intimated that Sabu was in New York City. This aligned with hints I'd gotten directly from him in our chats. But there were a lot of swirling rumors about Sabu, many maintaining, contrarily, that he lived in Brazil. It seemed equally credible. He worked closely with Brazilian hackers and often spouted off in Portuguese on Twitter. The information flowed both ways. I spoke about a number of anti-sec and non-ops IRC back channels and shared details pertaining to many black ops. His interest was piqued. And then I mentioned that I was raised in Puerto Rico. Upon hearing this, he offered point blank, "Do you want to meet Sabu?" He could arrange it. I was totally taken aback. I told him, "Meeting him intrigues me, but to be frank, I am skeptical." The conversation excited me, less due to the prospect of meeting Sabu. I truly was skeptical, and more for the taste of what many hackers experience all the time, the use of secrets as a valuable object of exchange. Those who write about secrecy commonly recount how an information seeker can, by providing a secret of his or her own, induce further disclosure from his or her interlocutor. Graham Jones, an anthropologist of magicians, describes sharing secrets as a token of recognition, a gesture of inclusion, a micro-ritual of initiation, and a move in a system of exchange. Sharing secrets can be about revenge or about forging trust. It can be a simple display of status or a measured revelation in the hopes of prompting a response. But whatever the reasons and whatever the mechanisms, secrets shared often do beget more secrets. Back in the bar, my mind raced. Is this guy just a regular guy, or is he working on behalf of the government? We did meet by chance, didn't we? Eventually, I decided to leave the bar. At home, exhausted, I transcribed every detail I could remember before passing out fully clothed. Early the next morning, I made my way to a neighborhood cafe as usual. A couple of hours later, sipping at my second or third coffee, I was lost in work. My IRC client, as was usually the case, was running but ignored. My name flashed on the screen, signaling a private message. Deep in work mode and allowing no interruptions, I attended to the query after 40 minutes had passed. I toggled to the window. Sabu.
Estás? Yo, you there?
Biela. Hi, yes, I'm here. Sabu.
Chequia tu fucking voicemail, loca.
Biela. LOL. I am wondering here, should I be doing this? Giving out my cell to one of the most notorious hackers of all time? Let me listen to the voicemail first, but you know someone you know has it. If I went to my office now, would you be able to talk? Or should I just listen to my voicemail? I am across the street at a coffee shop.
Sabu. Conobiela, just go listen and delete.
Back at my office, there was a message and a number. I called, and our first phone conversation lasted for an hour. Haughtily declaring himself the most trusted hacker, he asked, "What the fuck is up with the snitches?" He then launched into a three-part typology. First, there are the infiltrators. Second, there are those that want fame. And third, there are those that are pinned to the wall and don't want to go to jail. Almost everything he said made me blind to Sabu himself. But just in case I had my doubts, he hammered away with statements like, "Even if the FBI was outside my door and heard what I said, there's no way they could pin the technical act on me. That is why I am not locked up." At the time, this struck me as a perfectly plausible explanation. The rest of the conversation largely centered on politics, with him ranting and boasting and me listening. He railed against the NYPD, claiming they were far more corrupt than the FBI, willing to implant false information and break their own rules. He railed against Sony and AT&T, insisting that they were the criminals for the shitty state of their security. The conversation turned to WikiLeaks. He proclaimed it a tragedy that Assange had squandered an amazing opportunity, but ultimately expressed his love for Manning. Finally, I had to interrupt and ask, "Why reach out?" His reply was immediate. "My days are numbered," he reasoned. "This story needs to get out and the media will not do the job." The conversation wound down, leaving me to ponder just what he meant by this. It wasn't long before we talked again. This time he was on the street, evident from the noise of honking cars and the side conversations between him and his homies. He told me, "Cops are chasing a black kid over a bag of weed." This second conversation centered around his defense of Anonymous's style of hacking. "We are no skids," he insisted, referring to the eternally derided script kiddies. He described LulzSec as a
proof of concept, which had done more than any other hacker group in 15 years. He called AntiSec his brainchild. I was writing at breakneck speed, but unaccustomed to taking notes longhand, my cramping wrist proved unsuited to the task. Ultimately, none of it was too surprising. Until, that is, the end of the conversation. "I hope I don't sound like a dick," he started. "But I refuse to let my politics die. This is how I feel. I will continue to push for the idea of decentralized organizing." He paused and then continued, "With decentralization, it is harder to infiltrate. But there are snitches." He ended gruffly. He wanted war. "I want total revenge for Recursion. He is just a college student." Just days before, 23-year-old Cody Kretzinger from Phoenix, Arizona, had been arrested by the FBI in connection with hacking Sony Pictures with LulzSec. During these initial phone conversations, Sabu had intimated that he wanted to meet. I was growing interested in the prospect, but I was determined not to hold my breath. There was much to do in the meantime, as Anonymous's involvement in Occupy escalated. As camps sprang up across North America and Europe, a handful of core Anonymous veterans traded days and nights online for days and nights in the field. A few even found contingents of occupiers who identified as Anons, but had never logged into an IRC channel. On occasion, the two distinct, though complementary, movements directly crossed streams in a more dramatic fashion. On Sunday, September 25th, protesters gathered at Union Square and marched south toward the camp, until police enclosed them behind a length of orange plastic netting. Occupiers chanted, "Shame, shame, who are you protecting? You are the 99%, you're fighting your own people." A high-ranking police officer, Anthony Bologna, whipped out his can of pepper spray without provocation and directed the chemical stream at three young women. As the liquid engulfed their faces and stung their eyes, they crumpled to the ground, pleading, "No, why are you doing that?" Bologna answered by sauntering away. Onlookers filmed the entire incident, and the video went viral. Anonymous retaliated by swiftly doxing the officer, uploading his name and address to Pastebin. It opened with this message: "As we watched your officers kettle innocent women, we observed you barbarically pepper spray wildly into the group of kettled women. We were shocked and disgusted by your behavior. You know who the innocent women were. Now they will have the chance to know who you are. Before you commit atrocities against innocent people, think twice. We are watching. Expect us." Bologna's information was uploaded by a young female college student who earned her badge in the cabin crew for the effort. During an online interview I conducted with her, she explained the mechanics of her exposé. A lot of rewatching the video, zooming, trying to get facial features, badge number, and a partial name. It turns out that when I resorted to just a simple Google, I found out that he had previously been a problem with abuse and had a case against him. There was a pending lawsuit against him brought by a protester at the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York City. Since she did not strike me as someone who doxed for doxing's sake, I asked where she drew the line between acceptable exposure and privacy violation. "The police work for the public. Therefore, your life is public, just as a news organization would hound you." She continued, "Morally, I think there is a limit and boundary by which how deep the docs go," claiming she only disclosed information that identified Bologna himself. Other Anons, however, decided to go deeper, doxing members of his family. The NYPD defended Bologna's actions at first, but soon retracted. An internal police review determined that the officer had indeed violated protocol. As punishment, he lost 10 days of vacation and was reassigned to Staten Island, implicitly divulging the NYPD's opinion of the city's smallest borough. There was at least a silver lining. The incident helped catapult Occupy onto the national stage. The Guardian and other major news outlets reported on the event, quoting directly from Anonymous's Pastebin message and cementing a nascent association between Anonymous and Occupy. From that day on, and especially following the mass arresting of over 700 people during a peaceful march across the Brooklyn Bridge, Occupy became a fixture in activist circles and the mainstream media alike. Meeting Sabu. Thanks to a detailed FAQ published by the New York City Department of Information Technology and Telecommunications, we know roughly how many sidewalk payphones dot the five boroughs. As of January 2, 2014, there are 9,903 active public pay telephones on or over the city's sidewalks. I personally had never even noticed them until Sabu asked me to use one. He did not want to arrange a meeting online. It felt safer and prudent to use a payphone. Keyloggers are always a possibility with computers. Our first rendezvous was scheduled for soon after Bologna's doxing, on October 3rd, at the Chipotle on St. Mark's Place in the East Village. He assured me that you will recognize me. The one picture purporting to be Sabu floating around the web was of a wiry yet muscular Latino man. I arrived early. The minutes moved slowly, until suddenly I was aware of a tall, commanding figure sauntering toward me. Carrying his large body with aplomb, he seemed to be in his element. It was Sabu. He grabbed my hand, and I was afraid it would shatter in his grip. I gathered my things, and we went to order food. In the midst of our small talk, Sabu paused, casually nodded to the food prep worker, a tough-looking Latina, and asked, "What's up?" She replied, "I've not seen you here in a while." As would become increasingly clear, whether in Chipotle, a local diner, or Tompkins Square Park, many locals knew Sabu and treated him with deference. Out of respect or fear, I can't say which, but he was clearly a known quantity in the neighborhood. Before long, he steered the conversation toward his past. "I came from a drug family," he divulged almost immediately, and then continued nonchalantly, "By the time I was 13 or 14, I carried $4,000 to $5,000 in cash in my wallet." He also explained that he was the father figure to his adopted cousins, both younger than 7 at the time, though he left the reason for taking on such massive parental responsibilities unstated until later. When Sabu was 13, his aunt and father were sent to jail for dealing heroin. He was raised by his grandmother until she passed away on June 7, 2010, exactly 1 year before he was apprehended by the FBI. Upon her passing, he assumed parental responsibility for his cousins. Sabu said that he worked hard to overcome a ghetto mentality, an immobilizing mixture of self-hatred and anger. Later, he briefly recounted a few episodes that substantiated his everyday experience with harsh racism. Sabu attended Washington Irving High School, near East 16th Street, alongside many poor students. One day, entering the school, he walked through a metal detector and, carrying a screwdriver, was stopped by a guard. He defended himself. "I am the geek that fixes your system when you forget not to execute weird EXEs." The guard bought none of it, and a tiff between the two ensued. Sabu, who felt disrespected, complained to the administration, but found only deaf ears. So he made some noise by penning a strident and self-described controversial missive and circulating it to teachers. The principal deemed it threatening, and he was temporarily suspended. Sabu, reflecting later upon the incident in a Pastebin document, concluded, "Very well, then. It is such a shame that one such as myself would have to be deprived of my education because of my writing." It made immediate sense then why Sabu found hacking, with its elevation of ideas and arguments, to be an appealing oasis. This is not to say that the zone of hacking is free of prejudice. Far from it. The white, male-dominant scene, with some hackers especially prone to acting out elitist cowboy bravado, is alienating and repellent to many. The barriers are especially pronounced in underground quarters that are composed nearly exclusively of male and a few transgender participants. Nevertheless, since ideas are, in theory, exalted over social pedigree, it has functioned as a safe space, at least online, for a class of technical weirdos. The social boundaries erected by hackers also exhibit contradictions. While the gender gap is vast, some identities, such as transgender, queer, or disabled, are more common and accepted. It took some time, but I eventually figured out that the chat room pound lounge on and on ops doubled at times as a gay pickup spot. Sabu's explanation that he rarely hangs out with hackers in person hints at the sort of partial freedoms provided by anonymity and technical skills online. After we said our goodbyes, I could not help but think of Sabu as a cooler and savvier version of Oscar Wao, the lead character in Junot Diaz's electrifying novel on the travails of being a corpulent, ostracized, hardcore sci-fi and fantasy-loving nerd of Dominican descent. The brief, wondrous life of Oscar Wao tells the story of Oscar as he shuttles between New Jersey and the Dominican Republic, bumbling through life while trying to fulfill a cherished rite of passage, getting laid. Sabu, like Oscar, is a consummate cultural boundary crosser, flitting easily between vastly different cultural spheres. Unlike Oscar, Sabu was no dud, and his machismo was overpowering. He was notorious for hitting on the ladies in Pound Anonops and told journalist Quinn Norton in a chat, "I like you, Quinn. Next time you're in New York, you can watch me hack naked." With me, he was more restrained, alternating between calling me Mi Amor, my love, and Cupcake. After our first meeting, now mentally equipped with a picture of Sabu, I resumed my chats with him. The Guardian newspaper had asked Sabu to write an op-ed about Occupy. He asked me to give some editorial feedback. Meanwhile, I attempted to convince him to be filmed for Brian Knappenberger's documentary, We Are Legion. "Sabu, also, if I do this thing with your boy Nap, you gotta make sure that nigga doesn't leak my identity." More than any other journalist covering Anonymous, Brian Knappenberger had sought out a wide cross-section of individuals, pouring his funds and time into a project he was wildly passionate about. I wanted to help him. That Sabu was considering doing it was great news, but I had to reassure him about my ability to be discreet and to impress upon Knappenberger the necessity of further discretion. My protocol was generally one of silos of interaction. When I chatted on public channels, an observer could get a sense of who I spoke with, but my private chats were largely confidential, following a protocol commonly adopted in Anonymous. Eventually, a small group of the journalist-slash-researcher confederacy, namely Knappenberger and Olson, knew I had met Sabu, but otherwise I kept it to myself. Our seemingly trivial conversations would sometimes become much more interesting in retrospect. For example, the following conversation, which happened the day after we first met, seemed relatively mundane at the time. "Sabu, and IO error is good people." IO error equals Tor developer Jacob Applebaum. "I'm trying to reach out to him. I know he's been supportive of me in the last year. I want to support him back." Biela: "Yeah, he has." Sabu: "During this time." Biela: "I know him well." Sabu: "They're trying to rail him." Biela: "For over 9 years now." Sabu: "Tell him I send my regards then." Biela: "I will, for sure." Sabu: "If there's anything we can do for him, to pass it through you." At the time, I interpreted this as a reasonable gesture of solidarity. Now, these chats, and his motivations for reaching out to me in the first place, look different. The "we" he referred to was not Sabu and Anonymous, it was Sabu and the FBI, privileged with direct access to all his conversations, including the one before. It would not be the last time he tried to reach out to Applebaum through me. The propensity to sympathize with others. In late October, as winds shook off the remaining leaves still clinging to branches, Occupy was blossoming. Organizers were branching out. Alliances with unions and other civil society groups yielded new rivers of people flowing into Liberty Square on October 15th, a planned day of action. As I marched for hours alongside throngs of strangers,
Everyone appeared energized and amazed by the vibrant turn Occupy had taken in the short course of a single month. The Occupy assemblies were opening tremendous space in American political discourse, reflected Nathan Schneider, who also noted that by mid-October, Occupy Wall Street had an approval rating of more than 50%, higher than President Obama or Congress. Naysayers and pundits would accuse Occupy of being led by lifestyle activists for fizzling out after being unable to drum up broad-based support, a misguided account made clear by the repressive crackdown that would come just 1 month later to stamp out many of the U.S. camps. Documents procured by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund through a Freedom of Information Act request reveal that most every law enforcement entity, Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, local police, fusion centers, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, and even, oddly, the Federal Reserve, took a keen interest in Occupy. Since the documents are so heavily redacted, it is hard to gauge the specific role played by each organization, but it is clear that, at minimum, they cast a wide net in monitoring Occupy protests, as the New York Times titled its piece covering the documents. One reason why Anonymous had already thrived for 5 years was that despite the arrests of members of the collective, its decentralized and online character had made preemption extremely difficult. This would not prove to be the case with Occupy. I continued to meet Sabu. On some occasions, his two younger brothers accompanied him. The older one was Sabu's sidekick. He admired him, and while not as technically proficient as Sabu, he loved to talk about computers. The younger one, who sported sleek, straight, black-as-night hair and a lot of muscles, was, like many teenagers, absorbed in thought, totally uninterested in the geek talk that consumed the rest of us. One meeting stands out. On an unusually warm November evening, we hung out in Tompkins Square Park with his brothers again. Then Sabu and I went to the Odessa, a classic New York City diner with a mind-boggling array of dining options. By now, one thing had become clear. Sabu was a talker. Entering the diner, Sabu greeted with a handshake a man whom I presumed to be the owner or the manager. Easing into a booth, we became one with the ageless nog-hide seats, their well-worn springs clenching us desperately. That day he broached a dizzying number of topics in the course of our conversation. Gentrification, the hacker fiber optic, Middle East politics, Occupy, his dog, whose name was China and who had an awful skin condition, the sociology of hacker crews, the anonymous haters, and dozens of other topics that his mind alighted upon. Among the deluge of details, a few stood out. It was the first time he mentioned a mysterious hacker he worked closely with, whom he called Burn. I now know him as Jeremy Hammond. Sabu boasted that he liked to own security companies while Burn liked to hit the police. And in this conversation, one thing became patently evident. More than anything else, Sabu seemed to genuinely care what others thought of not only himself, but the whole of Anonymous. His contempt for those critical of Anonymous, both journalists and random people on Twitter, was noticeable. He jeered at those who he felt had not treated him or Anonymous with respect. Soon after, winding down, he sighed in a weary voice. "I sometimes just want to walk away and quit." He did seem tired, and he had developed a chronic cough since our previous meeting. I knew he had also talked extensively with Olson over Skype, and it struck me suddenly that he had a burning desire for his life story to be put out into the world. When someone is wearing a mask, there is at least a symbolic reminder that insincerity, duplicity, and play might be at work. Sitting across from Sabu, seeing his face, hearing his voice, and looking into his eyes, I suspended my mistrust, even though I knew that with or without a mask, I really had no access to his true motivations. We can never really access the inner thoughts of other humans. We can only attempt to gauge sincerity or authenticity.
Then there's what Hume identified as one of the most enduring qualities of human nature. No quality of human nature is more remarkable, both in itself and in its consequences, than that propensity we have to sympathize with others. It's hard to constantly question people's motives. It is precisely the human proclivity to want to sympathize that enables the FBI to perform exploits through its informants. We left the Odessa, and, as usual, Sabu lit up a sweet-smelling cigarette. He took a deep puff from the white filter. And then, suddenly, he confessed, "I was indeed a criminal. I used to sell heroin." Then he walked away. Chapter 11. The Sabotage. Although Antisec had been on a hacking spree, compromising high-profile targets like the FBI, the group was not getting much attention, and the attention it did get was not exactly positive. Certain data dumps, such as those regarding police units, including the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, and the Sheriff's Office of Baldwin County, Alabama, struck some Anons as random and incoherent. Many people, even within Anonymous, didn't quite see the point. A supporter of information leaks, Anonymous 9 felt that anti-sex ops weren't cutting the mustard. "Just because a lunch menu at Fort Meade might be classified," he told me, "doesn't mean it is interesting, much less worth leaking." Then, just in time for Lull's Christmas, a mysterious hacker named Hiria delivered a gift. On December 13, 2011, a few anti-sec members pulled the journalist Quinn Norton and myself aside into a channel to ask a question. "Anti-sec, will journos cover stuff that's probably deeply illegal? LOL." Quinn: "Yes, but framing is important." Anti-sec 2: "Not illegal like DDoS or leaking some cops' emails." Biela: "Deeply as opposed to surface illegal." Anon: "We have a table of illegal categories." Anon checks the cheat sheet. Biela: "Anon, do you? LOLLL. Anon thinks, "Fuck, we are screwed." Quinn: "Is this like a mandatory minimums kind of chart?" Anon: "Ha ha." Biela: "Off the charts illegal." Soon after this chat, an anti-sec member casually informed me that they possessed credit card data and intended to use it for charitable donations. While he kept the source of the database a secret, it remained one of the few instances where sensitive information was sprung upon me. I publicly maintained my caveat. I could not guarantee the confidentiality of any information given to me. And, as if that wasn't enough to freak me out, Jeremy Hammond, using the name SupG, queried me on December 15th. "SupG, not sure if you are down, able, or safe to examine some data pre-release, but there's some mail spools available." Biela: "Not right now, sorry. Though I look forward to hearing about it." By now, my interactions with Hammond were limited and contained. Most of our conversations were rolled into group chats in the private cabin crew channel, where he was SupG, and in Barrett Brown's Project PM, where he was O. With time, I connected these two nicknames and remained undecided about him. He kept a pretty low profile, except when political discussions would draw him out, and suddenly he would flood the chat with his views in a rather heated fashion. Hammond was hands down the most insurgent of the bunch. Though his dedication was evident, I could not help but at times imagine him to be an agent provocateur. When he offered me a pre-release of the email spool, my alarms sounded. Is this entrapment? Unlike Brown, whose begging for these very emails fell on deaf anti-sec ears, he was never given them, I desperately tried to avoid receiving this kind of information. And anyway, why, after all my caveats and all their attempts to remain mum, were they suddenly offering to toss me all this information? It seemed fishy, and it stressed me out. Thankfully, a deeper reservoir of secrets was actually being kept from me. Most significant was that the anti-sec crew, at the onset of December, had become deeply suspicious of Sabu. As one member told me later, various hackers continued appearing at random and insisting, mantra-like, that Sabu is an informant. Hammond, too, had grown tired of Sabu's reluctance to get his hands dirty, an indicator that something was amiss. At the time, they kept their concerns to themselves. On Christmas Eve, anti-sec decided to publicly release the details of its most memorable and unforgiving hack. In a politically motivated act of corporate sabotage, anti-sec infiltrated the internal network of the global intelligence firm Strategic Forecasting, Inc., better known as Stratfor. Anti-sec collected over 50,000 credit card numbers, downloaded almost 8 years' worth of company emails, 5 million in total, and procured countless other records. As a finale, they